Welcome back, everyone. This is Sam.
And this is Corrine, and we are two Onc Docs.
So we're still here with Dr. Larry Einhorn. And before we move on to our non-seminoma treatment for germ cell tumor, Dr. Einhorn, we would love for you to tell us about the first testicular patient that you treated with platinum-based therapy and how, again, this changed the landscape for treatment forever.
Certainly. So John Cleland had just graduated from college, was newly married when he was diagnosed with metastatic testicular cancer. And this was before platinum chemotherapy was around. And so he was treated with actinomycin D. He was treated with an Adriamycin-Vincristine combination. He was treated with a drug that doesn't exist anymore called mithromycin. And so we saw him for fourth line therapy. And he was the first patient in the world to get platinum combination chemotherapy with what then was platinum vinblastine bleomycin. So John was completely asymptomatic. He had a job, had just started teaching high school mathematics here in Indianapolis. He had multiple pulmonary metastases that were growing. He had elevated tumor markers, but no symptoms. And what we knew about platinum at that time is that it caused horrendous nausea and vomiting. And that's another podcast as to what we do about nausea and vomiting, which I won't get into now. But by tremendous nausea and vomiting, that meant that the average patient would have 12 emetic episodes on day one, and then continue with day two, three, four, and five, and then start all over again 3 weeks, 6 weeks, and 9 weeks later. And we explained that we knew what the toxicity was. We knew that single agent platinum had activity as second line therapy or third line therapy. And by activity, it meant that of the first 11 patients that were treated, 8 of the 11 responded, which is really very exciting for a phase one study. However, the longest response was about 7 months. And so the idea of adding platinum to vinblastine bleomycin, we hoped it would buy them a little bit of time. We didn't really harbor any high levels of enthusiasm that this could cure his disease. But this is a miracle of platinum, and it's so synergistic with many different drugs, such as etoposide, 5-fluorouracil, and of course also vinca alkaloid. And John went through the therapy, and he comes back 3 weeks later after his first course, and everything had disappeared. In fact, I still remember the radiologist calling me up because he was so used to these patients having the next x-ray with progressive disease, wanting to know what we treated him with. And he got his 4 courses of therapy, suffered a great deal of toxicity with that. And he actually lived almost 50 years. He died a little over a year ago, probably from chemotherapy-induced malignancies, because he had had a lot of chemotherapy before he had the platinum chemotherapy, as I mentioned. His wife, Judy, we were able to raise funds from patient donors, and we've endowed a fellowship in his honor, because it takes a great deal of courage to sign that consent form, knowing the toxicity and knowing that it might not make you live one day longer. And I'm not sure if I would have done that if I were a patient and, you know, wanting to just be asymptomatic and live my life out and eventually die rather than go through what he had to go through.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And I know everyone at IU at one point we have interacted or taken care of Mr. Cleland, and it really is medical history. So thank you for sharing that story with us. And so now diving back into non-seminoma treatment, can you talk about how we treat stage one non-seminoma disease?
Certainly. So once again, stage one is everything is normal serologically and radiographically after the orchiectomy. So there are known risk factors for having micrometastatic disease when the patient has stage one clinical disease. The most important is lymphovascular invasion. The second most important is the predominant cell type being embryonal carcinoma. So if you have lymphovascular invasion, you have a 50% probability you have micrometastatic disease. And non-seminomas is just as likely to be hematogenous in the lung as opposed to lymphatic in the retroperitoneal. That's very different than seminoma, which is only going to be in the retroperitoneum as initial spread. If you have a 50% probability of recurrence, we offer patients 3 options. One is to give 1 course of adjuvant BEP chemotherapy, and that will lower that 50% chance of recurrence to 1 or 2%. Secondly, we can tell patients that the most common, not the only, the most common site of spread is the retroperitoneum. And so we have a good urologist offering to do a retroperitoneal lymph node dissection, RPLD. And by a good urologist, I mean one that can do a nerve-sparing RPLD so we don't get retrograde ejaculation. And if you can remember your anatomy textbook, when arteries and veins are red and blue and the nerves are white, it's not that easy when you open up the abdomen. It's not color-coded. So in order to separate out the nerves and not sever the nerve and cut the sympathetic plexus and cause a retrograde or simply failure of ejaculation is very important. And the third option is surveillance. And we know from multiple international studies that all three of these options will lead to a near 99% cure rate. Most patients choose surveillance, being risk adverse. Many patients will choose an RPLD and come here with our outstanding urologists, Clint Carey and Tim Masterson. And probably the least common thing that we see is getting the one course of BEP. And that's what we talked about with stage one seminoma radiation therapy or carboplatin. Chemotherapy, especially 5 days of cisplatin, is no fun. The acute side effects are well known to everybody on the podcast. I won't go into that. But once again, it's the late complications of even one course of platinum as far as cardiovascular disease with that hazard ratio of 1.8, as well as, of course, the risk of second malignancy. We always tell patients there are no wrong decisions. The only wrong decision would be to choose surveillance and not go in regularly for the appropriate follow-up.
Agreed. It's all risk benefit and what patients are comfortable with and sticking with their plan.
Parents are comfortable with too.
Exactly.
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, Dr. Einhorn, so important to remember that for stage one non-seminoma, we have the option of surveillance if someone can be compliant with the schedule, or RPLND, or one cycle of adjuvant BEP.
And then what about the treatment of stage two and three non-seminoma? What's a brief overview of those?
Sure. So for stage two disease, we actually look at tumor markers and the size and number of lymph nodes. So if you have normal HCG and AFP post-orchiectomy, and you have a lymph node that is between 1 and 3 centimeters in size in the typical location, so a right-sided testis typical location is inter-aorta cable, a left-sided testis tumor typical location is to the left of the aorta, what we call a para-aortic lymph node. So those are what are called suspicious lymph nodes. They're not definitive lymph nodes because you can get reactive lymph nodes in many situations, including in testis cancer. So what we do for that patient is we give them two options. We would not give an option of one course of BEP because it might be stage two disease rather than stage one disease. We would not give three courses of BEP because they may be cured with the orchiectomy alone. So the two options are to go ahead and do an RPLD, which would be appropriate if it is stage two disease at the time of RPLD, or even if it's a reactive lymph node, or we simply have them come back 4 to 6 weeks later, repeat the CT scan. If it's a reactive lymph node, it would be a smaller or decreasing or disappeared lymph node, and then we offer them the three options. Now, if it's a tumor that goes from 2 centimeters to 3 centimeters, then we prefer to do an RPLD rather than BEP chemotherapy. If it's larger than 3 centimeters or is multifocal lymph nodes in multiple different areas, surgery, of course, is local regional. Chemotherapy is systemic. So we would do chemotherapy usually at our center, BEP times 3, unless there's some contraindication to bleomycin for stage 2 disease. And very close to 100% of those patients will be cured with the therapy. Now, you are also stage 2 disease if you have a 10-centimeter retroperitoneal mass and you have an alpha fetal protein that is less than 1,000 and an HCG that is less than 5,000. That obviously is different than a marker-negative patient with a 2-centimeter lymph node gone to 3 centimeters that gets an RPLD or eventually gets chemotherapy. So stage 2 disease is pretty rare to die from stage 2 disease. But again, there may be a higher burden of therapy than just doing an RPLD on those patients.
Yes. So as you mentioned, Dr. Einhorn, the size and number of lymph nodes definitely matters in stage 2 disease. And if a patient has non-retroperitoneal lymph nodes, as you mentioned, retroperitoneal includes intra-aortocaval and para-aortic, or has mediastinal non-seminoma, as we mentioned last week, or has other non-lung metastasis, or have elevated tumor markers, then we do have to escalate to the higher regimen of BEP times 4 or VIP times 4. And also, as we mentioned last week, it sounds like the preference may be for VIP times 4 for mediastinal non-seminoma. And remember that elevated tumor markers is if you have an AFP over 1,000 or an HCG over 5,000, where they do meet the criteria for the 4 cycles. And so then how do you approach patients with residual disease that have non-seminoma?
Sure, that's so very different than seminoma, because the residual mass in seminoma is going to almost always be necrosis and rarely be seminoma and never be teratoma. So a residual mass and a residual mass by size criteria means that post-chemotherapy, it is larger than 1 centimeter in horizontal diameter. So a residual mass can be necrosis, it can be persistent cancer, or it can be teratoma. And we know from our large experience that if you have teratoma in the orchiectomy specimen and have a residual larger than 1 centimeter mass, 80% of the time when you do a post-chemo RPLD, it's going to be teratoma. But if you have no teratoma in the orchiectomy specimen and you have a residual mass, let's say it was 5 centimeters and now it's 2 centimeters, and you do the post-chemo RPLD, 40% of the time it's going to be teratoma. So bottom line, any residual mass larger than 1 centimeter, once the tumor markers have normalized, you need a good urologist to do that post-chemotherapy RPLD. Very different than for seminoma.
It is. And so in the salvage setting for non-seminoma disease, can you tell us about the TIGER trial and sure. what we use and also that role of transplants that we alluded to at the beginning of this episode?
Sure. So salvage chemotherapy, in the term salvage, means that you can still salvage with curative intent, not just palliative and prolongation of survival. So when a patient is not cured with BEP times 3, EP times 4, VIP times 4, EP times 4, BEP times 3, and they have rising tumor markers with or without radiographic progression, they have progressive disease. And they're going to die if they're not getting further therapy. Now, on rare occasion, the initial disease is in the retroperitoneum, and the progressive disease is in the retroperitoneum. And in that setting, and that's an uncommon setting, it's not salvage chemotherapy, but it's salvage surgery with a good urologist doing an RPLD. And that will cure about a third of the patients. Now, most of the patients have multifocal disease, or have disease that's not necessarily amenable to easy surgery. So if the idea of salvage chemotherapy is you want to give different drugs than they've had before, and platinum, of course, is the major horse in this race. So you're not going to repeat the same identical chemotherapy. You're going to get a remission again, but it's going to be shorter duration. So if you're going to do standard dose chemotherapy, and they're not platinum refractory, and platinum refractory means that they progress within 4 weeks of their last course of platinum, standard dose initial chemotherapy, you want to give platinum with drugs they haven't had before. So that would be TIP, Taxol Ifosfamide Platinum, or VEIP, Vinblastine Ifosfamide Platinum, which are probably equivalent, although there's never been a phase 3 study. So one option is to give 4 courses of that type of therapy. Another option is to look at high-dose chemotherapy, which, by the way, has been a miserable failure in diseases like melanoma and breast cancer. Mm-hmm. But testis cancer is different because this is autologous, not allogeneic transplant. And the success has nothing to do with the transplant, which is just supportive care. It is just ability to use the best drugs available. So we can safely give 5 times the dosage of etoposide as long as we give patients back their hematopoietic stem cells, which used to be bone marrow transplant, now is peripheral blood stem cell transplant. But we cannot give 5 times the dosage of cisplatin, or everyone would be on dialysis, they'd be crippled with neuropathy and be having horrendous nausea and vomiting. Yeah. And that's where carboplatin comes in. Carboplatin is minimally less effective milligram per milligram compared to cisplatin, which is why it's not used in metastatic diseases first-line therapy. But it's major, not only It's major dosimetoxicity toxicity is myelosuppression. So here we have two outstanding drugs. We're dealing with patients who never have bone marrow involvement, so you're not reseeding back tumor cells when you give them back their hematopoietic stem cells. They're young and healthy and can go through the rigors of this type of therapy. And as I mentioned before, with high-dose chemotherapy as second-line treatment, two-thirds of these patients, miraculously, are going to be cured. And incidentally, for reasons I don't understand, if you have pure seminoma with normal AFP and you have progressive disease, 90% of patients are cured with high-dose chemotherapy for two courses as second-line therapy. Now, the TIGER study was done with the idea that we don't know whether it's best to do four courses of standard-dose platinum ifosfamide-based chemotherapy or to do high-dose chemotherapy. High-dose chemotherapy, by definition, is going to be more toxic, more expensive, and more time in the hospital. And that's what the TIGER study was, and it's now been completed. And the TIGER study randomized patients to high-dose chemotherapy versus the four courses of TIP, Taxol, which, of course, is paclitaxel, ifosfamide, platinum. We probably will know the result of that study. And most of these patients were treated outside the United States. But we'll have the results of that study probably next year for ASCO, at least as far as progression-free survival. Now, at Indiana University, we have been a champion, as you know, of phase three studies. As a faculty, we regretfully decided not to participate on that study, which is really too bad because we would have been the major contributor because of the high volume that we see. So we decided not to do it for several reasons. First of all, you're either all in or all out. So TIP for patients who are platinum refractory has a zero cure rate. We would not randomize patients to that. If patients got VIP, we wouldn't want to randomize them with a 50-50 chance to get TIP. Taxol's not that good of a drug. If patients have mediastinal non-seminomas germ cell tumor, the cure rate with TIP is zero. And also, a retrospective analysis was done by our European colleagues looking at American, European, Canadian, and Australian data. This is 1,500 patients. It wasn't a randomized study. And we looked at the patients that got second-line therapy with a platinum ifosfamide combination or second-line therapy that got high-dose chemotherapy as their second-line therapy. And there was a 15% higher cure rate. Now, obviously, there's biases to who gets high-dose chemotherapy and who gets standard-dose chemotherapy. But for those reasons, we felt that we did not have equipoise. Equipoise means that you think that either arm can be superior or equivalent. And we felt that standard-dose chemotherapy had a probability of being inferior and no probability of being superior, although it certainly would be less toxic. So we're never the Oracle of Delphi and can look into the future and know what's going to happen. We may be wrong. It may be that there's no benefit in high-dose chemotherapy, a second line as opposed to third-line therapy. But I would tell you that if you're given four courses of platinum for first line and four courses of platinum for second line, and you have to do high-dose chemotherapy for third line, the ototoxicity and neurotoxicity is durable and very life-altering. So again, I'll be interested to see what the TIGER study showed. As almost certainly, progression-free survival is going to be better with high-dose chemotherapy. Whether overall survival is better will be another several years later that we'll know that.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to the initial results of the TIGER trial, hopefully next year, as you alluded. And we talked about some of the acute toxicities of some of these treatments. Are there any other notable late toxicities that we haven't mentioned yet? And how often do you recommend fertility preservation for your patients?
Always. So you have to do that before they get therapy. So when someone is cured with initial platinum chemotherapy, 60% of the time, the sperm count will return to normal. There's no risk of congenital malformations. It takes at least 1 year for the sperm count to return to normal. Most of the side effects of chemotherapy go away pretty quickly. So we recommend sperm, let me rephrase that. We talk to patients about sperm banking before they start chemotherapy. The only time that we don't is when someone has absolutely massive disease and you want to start chemotherapy last week and you don't even want to wait a couple of days to set up sperm banking and to do sperm banking. But all patients, that should be offered. Now, if they've had first-line therapy, and now you're looking at salvage chemotherapy, and they haven't done sperm banking, that's a different situation. It's unlikely sperm banking is going to be very productive in that setting. And by the way, when people get high-dose chemotherapy or salvage chemotherapy and they get so much platinum, you're getting into single digits as far as ability to have spermatogenesis and naturally father a child. So we always offer sperm banking prior to first-line chemotherapy. But by the time they progress 3 months later, it's probably little of any sense because they're going to be close to azoospermic at that time.
Absolutely. So important to offer fertility preservation. And so, Dr. Einhorn, thank you so much for covering such a great overview of seminoma and non-seminoma. We just have a couple questions for you in terms of trainees interested in academic medicine and in oncology. Do you have any career advice for early trainees?
Well, I think going into industry, going into private practice, going into academics, we are healers and we take care of patients. And we have a unique relationship that no other branch of medicine, surgery, orthopedic surgery, neurosurgery has with their patients. And it's a great career and you should pat yourself on the back for choosing that career. I think those of us that are involved in academics, we like the idea of being innovative and being the first to do clinical trials. You get a great deal of personal satisfaction by curing someone with BEP in South Bend, Indiana, or in Lagodi, Indiana, or any other part of the Indiana of the United States. But you get even more benefit to yourself and your personal satisfaction if you're involved in clinical trials and actually writing the clinical trial yourself. And also in academics, we get to see the best and the brightest who go into oncology. And if you love teaching and you love being stimulated by these incredibly bright people who go into medical school and go into hematology oncology fellowships, academics is for you. But we're very proud of everyone who's gone through our program, whether they're in private practice, whether they work at Eli Lilly here at the industry or anywhere else, or whether they go into academics. We do not twist anyone's arms to go into academics. We try to give them a fair appraisal as to what life is like in all these different situations. And we offer them the opportunities to look at these different situations. But for me, I would never have thought of doing anything other than academics, but that's me.
Agreed. Thank you so much again, Dr. Einhorn, for joining us with these episodes, giving us words of wisdom and talking us through the full treatment of seminomas and non-seminomas. You guys are hearing it, you know, from the expert himself, the man who's changed the landscape. So I think this is one of the best episodes we've had. Thank you guys for listening to us. Good luck with studying for your boards. And always, please feel free to reach out to us with corrections or comments on our Instagram or our Twitter, @OncDocs. Have a great week. So this has been a fabulous two-part episode of talking through seminoma as well as non-seminoma germ cell tumors. And so, Corrine, what are our key takeaways for both these episodes?
So we have so many pearls in both of these episodes. I think one thing to remember is that you will not see AFP in seminoma.
Remember that risk stratification markers are post-orchiectomy. And remember criteria when a patient may need an escalated 4 cycles of chemotherapy compared to 3 cycles. So if you have intermediate or poor risk disease, that is if your AFP is over 1,000, your HCG is over 5,000, if you have a non-pulmonary metastases, if you have non-retroperitoneal lymph nodes, or if you have mediastinal primary non-seminoma, that's when the options are BEP times 4 or VIP times 4. I think that's a good way to remember. Just remember the ones that get the escalated dose. Also know how to manage a residual mass in both seminoma, which is over 3 centimeters, and in non-seminoma, which is significant if it's over 1 centimeter. And in non-seminoma, that's where you're usually going to do surgery. And there is that concern for teratoma as well.
Great. And so thank you guys so much for being with us. Thank you, Dr. Einhorn, for joining us. And as always, thank you for listening. Good luck with studying for your boards. Please feel free to reach out to us with our corrections or comments on our Instagram or our Twitter, @OncDocs.